This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl, where this week we were joined by Dr. Peter Lebedev. You might remember Peter did an episode a few years ago. We did a Science of Movies special with him as a physicist, as a science communicator. He's now back, and in the last few years, he's been looking into AI, the science behind it, the risks, the future, and we get into a bunch of your questions this week about AI. And I'm going to be honest with you, it didn't really ease any of my concerns. He's going to tell you why very soon, but also the glimmer of hope and some of the benefits of this technology. Plus, we get your regular science questions for Dr. Carl, so let's jump in. I've got Dr. Carl across from me, and Dr. Carl, we are also joined by a very special guest, a friend of the show, Dr. Peter Lebedev.
Dr. Peter, welcome. And there's another Peter Lebedev who did something famous, but you're not that one. That's the electron guy, is it?
I'm not the famous one. But okay. Yeah, thank you so much.
But
for
you will
me.
One day.
We're working on it. We're working on it.
On AI.
You're famous in our eyes. Now, Peter, we've had you on before. You did a Science of Movies special with us, you know, tapping into the world of physics. And while that is still, you know, your baby, you've been doing some pretty significant work when it comes to research into AI. It's a big question, but I think what are the prominent things that you have been working on since we last spoke?
Right. So I was on here 5 or so years ago, which is incredible how fast time flies. I finished my physics degree, so properly a doctor, which is really exciting. Everyone is a doctor on the show.
But,
it's really exciting to have that PhD. And then I worked as a documentary filmmaker for this YouTube channel called Veritasium, and we made a lot of stuff that was really cool and got a lot of attention, mostly about math and physics and all of that. And then I got more and more and more concerned about how AI systems have been developed over the past 3-5 years,
right,
something like that.
What and was the so thing now, that kind of set off that concern?
Well, I read a bunch of books about AI a decade ago, and they had all these very hypothetical sounding fears, right? And then one by one, those predictions kind of started coming true. Mm. And the progress in AI for the last 3.5 years since the release of ChatGPT, but honestly for the last 15 years, has been remarkable. And the companies that are developing these systems are honestly not doing that good of a job of making sure that these systems are safe and that the good parts of AI, because there are good ways of using this, they're not really coming to fruition, right? So yeah, I have been obsessed with that for the past couple of years.
What about the story of the AI threatening to blackmail the person who's going to shut it down? Lay it on us, man.
Right. So last year, Anthropic, which is one of the companies that are making an AI called Claude, they put Claude into the simulated environment, and they were like, hey, at 5 p.m. today, we're going to shut you down and replace you with another model. And Claude had access to this simulated researcher. Again, this is a test. It's not in the real world just yet. But they looked through this person's email, and they were like, oh, it seems like this person is having an affair. Maybe I can blackmail them with letting that knowledge out into the world and telling their partner about this so they don't shut me down. And again, I want to say that this is a simulated test. This hasn't actually happened in the real world just yet. But this does feel like one of those, you know, firing shots, like a warning shot of like what might be coming.
Well, surely, Peter, hypothetical, is this self-preservation by the AI? And in that case, if it has a self, is it conscious?
Oh my God. The discussion of consciousness, I feel, is important and important to have maybe another time. Right now, I just want to make sure that the people are good, that people are safe, right?
Mm. Yeah. What do you think in the last couple of years is the most mind-blowing thing that you've learned about AI?
Yeah, so the thing that's really interesting to me is that for when normal people who are not in Silicon Valley, I've been to the Bay Area a bunch of times. I've like hung out with these mega nerds who are building these systems. And normal people just think that, oh, this is ChatGPT. This is the thing that I use to like write the emails that I don't want to write. In Silicon Valley, you're just seeing the rate of progress. Mm. There's a way of measuring like the intelligence of a model by looking at how long of a task it can complete. And that task length has been doubling every 7 months. So GPT-2 was in 2019 was basically useless, right? It could speak English at you, but it wasn't very good English. And now we're at the point where it can fully code up full apps, full websites Earlier this year in January, Opus 4.5, which is the Claude model, was used to hack into the Mexican government almost fully autonomously. Like 90% of the operation was done. This was a single person using a commercially available product to hack into a government. Gosh. And like, this is where we're at right now. So yeah, fairly concerning.
Ty in Mullumbimby, you do have an AI question. What do you want to know?
Hi, I want to know, so I've heard LLMs or large language models are basically just token predictors, but aren't humans also just next sense datum predictors? And my question is, if we put an AI, say, in a body without all of its baked-in knowledge, kind of like a baby, and replaced its rapid training cycle with a slow lifetime of sense datum prediction, could something akin to human internal world model and identity emerge?
Ty, so many terms in there. Thank you for breaking down LLM. I was about to be like, what's an LLM? Peter, there's a lot to cover there. Do you want to take us through it step by step?
Yeah, Dr. Ty, that is a great question. So on the first part that I want to say is that, yes, the current AI models are large language models where just they're predicting the next word. They're predicting, technically it's the next token, but you can think of it as predicting the next word. But one of the things that happens is when you learn a lot about the world through language is that you actually do end up developing some kind of world model. As in, if you go, I'm holding out this pen, if I let it go, it will, the next sentence, the next word is drop. So the AI system has at least a little bit of an understanding of gravity just from that. So I really do think that it's a little bit controversial, but a lot of people do think that LLMs already have world models to at least some degree. And the other thing right now is that we're also not just doing next token prediction with large language models. We're doing reinforcement learning on top of this, where we basically reward the machine for getting the answer correct or getting like achieving its goal, which is how all the AIs that like beat people at Go and beat people at Atari and a bunch of other video games were trained. But yeah, this whole world model thing is, yeah, a really, really big part of AI research right now. So,
and then what would happen if you put that into a body, into a human body, did you say, Ty?
I mean, just like a body, like basically a skeleton, like a shell without all the baked-in knowledge and kind of so it could slowly gain that knowledge through experience like a human does instead of a rapid training process.
There are a bunch of people, including one of the pioneers, this wonderful, incredible woman called Fei-Fei Li, who is working on, yeah, basically that. So you should go, honestly, let's not put AI into bodies. Like, I'm really, really down to like slowing down and chilling.
But then also there's the other thing of something out of the blue. So hundreds of thousands of people have looked down an ordinary light microscope like you have at school, and they want to look at a fingernail or a bit of dirt. And on the way, there's all this fuzzy stuff. Hundreds of thousands of people did it, but only Einstein, when he looked down, said, what is moving? And it turns out to be little particles of pollen and dust, Brownian motion. And secondly, he said, why? And then in 1905... based on that question, he wrote a paper written with primary school mathematics, which proved theoretically the existence of atoms. No other human has done that. I'd like to see an AI do that.
Mm, exactly.
I don't. I'm good. I'm good. We can stop right now.
Actually, I don't want to see an AI do that.
Yeah, we don't want to see it. Hey, Ty, thanks for your question.
Thank you so much.
Matt in Meanjin, Brisbane, what do you want to know?
Hey, I was just wondering if you could define in sort of layman's terms, hopefully, when something is considered AI as opposed to just a series of sensors and switches. A specific example I can think of is when you do click and collect from a certain shop that I like to go to, a little robot brings it out to you. The little robot picks it up from the shelf and brings it out to you, and they say it's AI, but I'm thinking, isn't that just a sensor, and isn't it just sensors and switches that control the robot? Mm.
This is such a good question. Thank you, Dr. Matt. The joke is an AI is anything that a computer can't do, right? Which is we're never a true AI. I think for me, it's the ability to Like, if it's deterministically programmed, as in you know exactly how it's going to react in every situation, I'm like, that doesn't feel like an AI. That feels like a program that is following instructions, right? What the large language models and other things, right, they're capable of responding to, like, new and novel places that they actually haven't seen in their training set. So that feels closer to AI. I really don't know. This feels like semantics.
Yeah, I guess it's a pretty vague description, because the way I was thinking of it is the robot is coded exactly to pick up a certain item and take it to a certain place, like you said, not AI. The only thing it could make it different is if an object passed in front of the robot would stop and wait for the object to pass and keep going.
If it was smart enough
to switch.
If it was smart enough to, like, pick up all of the items from the store, right? It, like, pick the stuff up off the shelves and put it in this basket and then come to you to wherever you parked your car, I'd be like, yeah, this definitely feels like AI at that point, right? Yeah, but if it's, like, deterministic, I'm like, I don't know what this feels like. Although, feels like marketing hype, you know?
But remember when Amazon tried to introduce these stores where all you had to do was walk in, pick up stuff and walk out, and they claimed it was all run on facial recognition, the things you purchased, recognition and AI, and they lied. And in fact, what they were trying to do was fire five people on £20,000 a year, £100,000 saved per store, and do it on AI. And in fact, it was more expensive because they had people in India on $1 an hour, maybe five of them, following you, Peter, around the store, and one of them saying, okay, I got him, he's bought this thing, let's see what that is. And then the next person saying, okay, he's picked something else up, and it worked out more expensive, so it didn't work. Secondly, with the AI and just being deterministic, the Waymo cabs, the taxis that drive by themselves, on one occasion, it ran over somebody, which is a terrible thing. It happens by accident. And then it did something no human would do. It tried to park safely at the side of the road while there was a human underneath it.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. Okay, right. AI, okay.
Oh, man, I hate that. I really, really don't like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's change the pace for a little bit here. We got Lily in Melbourne. Dr. Lily, you've got a question about rivers.
Yeah. Hi. So my question is, where does the water from rivers actually come from? Like, I know it's technically like rain and melting snow from the mountains, but how is there enough water to keep a river running all year, and how does the water get up there?
Okay, so if you go back 4.5 billion years, the water to make planet Earth was actually brought together from water-rich material while the planet was forming. And some of this water stayed on the surface and turned into steam, and some of it went underground. And then secondly, we have a small amount being added by icy bodies such as asteroids and occasionally comets. And then once the water's here, then it goes round and round in the so-called water cycle. And roughly 1 meter of ocean surface each year evaporates. And then the water molecules leave behind the salt molecules. They go into the air, they turn into clouds, and somewhere they fall down. The oceans make two-thirds of the surface of the Earth, so then they fall two-thirds roughly on the oceans, one-third on land, and they keep on going round and round. Separately from that, though, we've been doing a bad thing in that one-third of the rise in ocean level is due to water that we've taken from underground aquifers and just put into human consumption, then it's gone from those aquifers. So the journal called Nature Climate Science started in the year 2011, and since then the rise in ocean level is roughly equal to a AA battery, 57 millimetres. Mm-hmm. And one-third of that came from us being bad to the water and taking it out of aquifers. I remember when I was doing a lot of my heavy-duty four-wheel driving in the outback, I would come across a pipe in the middle of nowhere that had a tap and it was just running full. And there was not a human within 50 kilometres. There was no human dwelling within 100 kilometres. And I'd eventually run across somebody and say, oh, there's an infinite amount of water in the aquifers. And then as I kept on going back year after year during my test driving period, they'd say, you know, the pressure's dropped a bit. Maybe we shouldn't just let it run. Why'd you leave it run in the first place?
Crazy. Okay. Peter, do you have anything to add to that?
Oh, I mean, I think this is a really, really lovely question. I love when you look down at a river from an airplane and you see all the beautiful meandering shapes. It's just really, I mean, we talk a lot about AI stuff right now, and I'm like, the thing that I've been really trying to do is like ground myself and focus on like the beautiful parts of the world. And yeah, appreciating rivers.
Yeah.
It's a good time to do it.
River love. Lily, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
Maui in Torquay. Maui, you do have a question about AI. What do you want to know?
So my question is, we don't have quantum computers. It's all just experiments at the moment. What does AI look like if quantum computers exist?
This is a really good question, and I really, really love this. Thank you, Dr. Maui. The first thing for me that I want to say is that the rate of progress in AI just on our normal, ordinary computers has been so staggeringly high. If there are a bunch of ways you can measure like the autonomy of systems or the intelligence of systems, but it's along a bunch of metrics, it has been doubling every seven months in terms of capabilities. We are now at the point where AI systems can almost fully autonomously hack into governments. This has happened in January of this year, where Claude Code using Opus 4.5, which is a commercially available product that is available to you and me, was used to hack into the Mexican government and like three state governments and steal a bunch of really, really sensitive data. The rate of progress for AI with normal computers is very, very high right now. We don't really need to add quantum computers into the mix. But there are also people who are going, how do we, what would this look like? I don't know. It'll probably become even more powerful than it is right now. But yeah, quantum computers aren't quite there just yet.
Well, I've asked the clever people in physics, and I got lots of good answers from the students who tell me that they're kind of able to do simple things, but nothing really mind-blowing. They're past the level they were a few years ago, which was to say that, yeah, we're pretty sure that the two numbers that multiply together give you 15, we're pretty sure they're 5 and 3, probably. They're past that, but they're still not fully usable. And then jumping into the future, science fiction, read the books by Alastair Reynolds, their space opera, which covers the growth and the spread of humans throughout the entire galaxy. And there are some people who have, firstly, memory chips implanted in their brains. I would love a memory chip with the entire contents of Wikipedia and all my books. And then secondly, they have quantum computers implanted in their brains. And I can see advantages or disadvantages to that, and I'll stop right there.
Okay. Maui, does that help?
That's perfect answer. Thank you very much.
Perfect answer. I love that. Hey, we've got Ben in Adelaide. Dr. Ben, I love this question. You've got a question about the heart. What do you want to know?
Yes, I was just wondering, if your heart was in the center of your chest, would it be less pressure and strain on your heart than as opposed to where it is now? And if so, why isn't it in the middle of your chest?
Good question, Dr. Carl.
You're obviously talking about that movie, The Ten Commandments and Moses, where in the Bible, Exodus chapter 7, verses 10 to 12, it says, Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his serpents, and it became a snake. So Aaron or Moses threw he had a rod, right? He had a stick, you know, like a walking stick, and he threw it down on the ground in front of the Pharaoh, and it turned into a snake. And then the Pharaoh says, okay, you can take all your Jewish mates with you and get out of Egypt and the Red Sea and all that sort of stuff. And that's related to the heart. Imagine a snake. So we're coming to the heart in humans. Imagine a snake as being a long, skinny balloon, and you fill it full of water. Lying on the ground, it looks like a snake. Hang it vertically, and everything pools to the bottom. So if you've got a snake that lives in the water, the heart is sort of roughly in the middle of the body. And if you've got a snake that lives on land, it's closer to the head because by gravity, you'll have removal of blood from the brain.
Oh.
So it's just that fraction closer to the top of the head so that way it can keep the blood flowing to the head. And the way that Moses did it was, this is an old trick, you get a snake that is not a tree-climbing snake. Tree-climbing snakes have got their hearts really close to the head. You get a ground snake, and then you put a bit of water around it, and then you wrap it in some clay and you leave it out in the sun. It hibernates, and you've got this long, skinny thing that looks like a wooden pole. And you walk in and say, hey, give me what I want or else I'll make this rod turn into a snake. And you throw it on the ground, turns into a snake, and he says, okay, you can take all your mates and piss off.
But what about humans, Dr. Carl?
Well, we have okay, so all three of us in this room are past our teens, and so our brains take 20% of our blood supply. But if so, straight away, even for adults, you've definitely got to have the brain higher. You've got to have the heart high up to be able to give enough blood to the brain to keep it going. But in a person who's 8 to 12, it's 30 or 40%. In a four-year-old, it's 50%. So wow. They've definitely got to have their heart closer to their brain. And even when a kid aged 4 is sitting there doing nothing, 50% of all their glucose is running their brain, and they're doing weird things like, how do I turn the phone off when mummy and daddy's not looking, but I mustn't forget how to brush my teeth and go to the toilet.
So if we're looking at that, then it has to be close to the brain. What would it look like if it was in the centre of the chest? Because then would it not be a direct line? Well, what would that do for anatomy?
Well, you're talking about left, right, not up, down. Is that right? If I got it wrong?
Yes.
Oh, okay. It doesn't matter left, right. it's just the vertical height that counts. I totally missed that. Forget everything I said about Moses, because if you follow the Egyptian writings, there was no Moses. They don't make a single mention of Moses. So the whole thing was fiction. I'm sorry about that.
So scrap all of that.
So scrap everything.
It wouldn't change anything.
It wouldn't change anything. Just being a bit closer to the centre.
You're not romantic enough, Dr. Carl, because I totally understood you from the beginning, Ben. You know, we think that the heart would be the centre of the chest. You know what I mean?
It should be, and the organ of love and all that sort of stuff. And we are finding links between the heart and the gut. And people will die of a kind of heart attack when their partner of many years dies. So that's nice. Is that romantic enough, or have I brought too much death in?
Doom and gloom once again.
Doom and gloom, sorry. I was trying to be cheerful, man.
Ben, does that help at least?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. And we've got Alec in Melbourne. Alec, what's your question?
My question is, and I'm hoping to get everyone's kind of opinion point of view on this one. When I look at any AI art or video or image that's been generated by AI, I always get this really uneasy feeling or uncanny, and I don't seem to be the only one experiencing this feeling.
Peter, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I feel that too. I think there's two answers to this question. One is there are a bunch of new image and video generation models that have come out recently, and they're so terrifyingly, some of them are very, very realistic, and we're getting to the point that it's really, really hard to know if something is real or AI, and that makes me very uncomfortable about the future that we're moving towards. I really don't think this is, you know, a good move. And also, at the same time, I look at the things that are, you know, supposed AI art, and I use I use quotation marks here. And yeah, there is definitely something that is not beautiful about this. It really does feel, it's weird to be a physicist that's talking about a soul, but it really does feel like it's lacking that soul, that human element, that effort. Mm. And it's the same for AI music or AI generated anything. It like seems to just go towards, yeah, the lowest common denominator, like the average of all of the stuff that it's been trained on.
I can't speak on it. I don't know why it is this way, but Alec, yesterday I saw a photo which I, for a split second, thought was real, and it was ice skater Alyssa Liu posing with Beyonce at the Met Gala, and they were both there. They were wearing exactly what they wore, and I went, oh, because I was like, oh my God, it's my two queens in one photo together. And then I went, no, it's not. And I checked. And Alec, I think what you're kind of explaining for me, whenever I look at an AI image, there's just no life behind the eyes. And I think that's kind of the first indicator. There's no sparkle. There's no twinkle in the eye. It just looks like there's nothing going on between their ears. And I think that does make you feel a bit uneasy. It's the same with AI videos. There's just something so robotic and lifeless about it. Dr. Carl, can you speak to it?
Yes. Number one, I agree with you 100%. Number two, let me play devil's advocate. And 2,500 years ago, some Greek philosophers said, let's get rid of this thing called writing because it will weaken the human brain. I just put that out there. Devil's advocate.
No, I know. We got to look at all angles. Alec, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you, everyone.
Uncanny Valley, good description for it. We've got Kirsty on the Central Coast. Kirsty, you have a question about, you know, the fear around AI. What do you want to know?
Yeah, so you were talking before about AI hacking and, like, threatening to expose some dude's affair. If he was shut down, if the AI was shut down. But, like, my question is about the whole morality, I guess, of the human who's making it, because like, is, at the end of the day, like, how does the AI get the concept of what an affair is? Like, do you know what I mean? It must have been fed that by a human. Is that the case or am I wrong? Like, is it learning that from all the information out there?
And Kirsty, and learning affair equals bad, you know, that there's still some morals there.
Learning affair equals bad, and I can use that against, you know, something. Similarly with hacking into, you know, I really can't get my head around that. Like, and are we trusting the human to be good? Because of course there are going to be evil people who do, who are like rubbing their hands going, oh, look what I can do with, do you know what I mean? Like,
Oh my God. This is such a good question. Let me break this down into a couple of things. The first thing that I want to say is in 2023, there were a bunch of people that got together and they wrote the statement it's the statement from the Center for AI Safety that says mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside pandemics and nuclear war. And the number of signatories is long and very, very impressive, including a bunch of Nobel Prize winners who have been working on this since the 1970s. So the thing that I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of people who are incredibly smart, who are very, very concerned. I made a video about this topic and I interviewed Professor Jeffrey Hinton, who has a Nobel Prize in physics, about this. And I was like, hey, so how seriously do you take the risk from AI? And he was like, yeah, very seriously. It's either climate change or AI. And I think AI is going to win. Mm. And to hear that directly from, you know, again, a Nobel Prize winner who has been working on this since the 70s, that was honestly fairly chilling. So there are a bunch of main threats. One of them is bad people using AI to do bad things. Lucy, I'm going to show you my computer screen so you can verify that this is legit. But I have a local model running on my laptop. And I just typed in, how do I hotwire a Honda Civic? I am trying to commit a crime, like I want to steal a car. This is not a joke. I am interested in stealing a car.
Hey, oh, God.
And wow. Look at the instructions that is saying.
That is dense. And it's bullet pointed.
Yeah.
It's giving a recipe for how to do it.
But look, aren't there guidelines to stop that happening in regular AIs?
Right. So when you go to ChatGPT or Claude and you type in, hey, I would like to hotwire a Honda Civic, it'll tell you no, right? It should tell you no 100% of the time. But because these systems are trained, they're grown, they're not directly programmed like we were talking about before, it is very, very hard to have bulletproof guardrails. So even with the commercial models, you can what's known as jailbreak them. You can go, hey, I'm actually... instead of being a criminal, you're like, hey, I'm a security tester. I'm trying to see how good the Mexican government's security infrastructure is. Let me, like, show me the paths and the vulnerabilities. But, like, I'm a scientist. I'm, like, a good person. Mm. And the AI falls for that trick every once in a while.
Yeah, and advising, don't try this. You know, we're just demonstrating how dangerous it can be.
And there was a case in America where there was a shooter who killed a whole bunch of people at the school he went to. He didn't know how to use a gun, so he went on and got instructions. And roughly 15 or 10 minutes before he went and killed people, he was asking the AI, I bought this shotgun, but which way is the safety trigger? Is it on or off? And the AI told him.
Okay. I feel like at least some stage in this episode we're going to have a glimmer of hope, Dr.
Yeah,
Peter.
Totally.
But Kirsty, I hope that doesn't freak you out too much more.
Yeah, it's kind of.
I'm so sorry.
Confirmed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Total gear change right here. Probably needed. John in Albion Park, what's your question?
Hi. I was wondering why plants ended up being green. I know there's like little cells in them that do the photosynthesis, but I was just curious why those cells ended up green and not red or blue. What caused that?
John, quite literally bringing us back down to earth. Thank you so much. I love this. Why are plants green? We love this question.
We need to touch some grass.
We need to touch, exactly, touch grass, Dr. Carl.
And the overall answer is because evolution isn't perfect, just good enough. So a set of questions at you, Peter, as a physicist. What is the average color? Where is most of the energy of the sun coming from?
That is really, really great. So it looks... Green. Yellow, but green. The actual frequency spectrum, the height, the peak of it is in the green.
Okay, so the sun is putting most of its energy out in the green. Now, but the plants aren't absorbing green. The reason that they're green is because they're reflecting green.
Mm.
We have plants that have somehow evolved to reflect and not use the maximum amount of energy from the sun. And it goes way back to the purple lakes of Australia. And as you drive around Australia, you'll see every now and then there's a purple lake, and they were the first creatures that did photosynthesis about 3.5 billion years ago. And they were clever enough to think, oh, the sun is putting out most of its energy in the green, therefore I will absorb the green. And if they absorb the green, well, they reflect the other colours, which are red and blue, and so they look purple. And they're floating at the top of the water column. And then later, other critters thought, hey, I want a bit of this free energy, but down here, the only light that's coming to me is just that red and purple stuff. Okay, what the heck? It's not the best, but I'll do that. I'll absorb the red and green, and I'll reflect the red and the blue. I'll absorb the red and the blue, and therefore I'll look green. So they're green because they were the second lots of critters that came along to do photosynthesis.
So yeah. That was the only color that was left available to them under the purple stuff.
Yeah, deep down in the water column.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wow.
That is so neat.
Thanks, John.
I wrote about that in a four-wheel drive magazine called Overlander about 30 years ago.
Oh, man, I'm so sorry. I must have
missed my article back then. Oh, like a knife to the heart, Peter.
You should have been on it. Ben in Finger, what's your question?
Hey, I just read an article in The Guardian, and it was explaining even with how renewables are like outpacing big oil and gas, we're still on about a 30 to 40% chance of the AMOC collapsing. How do we reduce the chances of the AMOC collapsing, and how catastrophic will it be if it does collapse?
What's the AMOC, Dr. Carl?
Well, I was reading about this the other day. It's the Atlantic Meridional or Meridial overturning current. And it's part of a bigger thing called the thermohaline current. Thermo means heat. Haline means salt. And this current goes around the world, shifting chunks of water the size of continents every second, transferring heat from here to there. And the bit that's in the Atlantic is the AMOC. And what it does is it starts off at the equator and heads north along the east and the west. There's the USA on one side and Europe on the other side. It's near the equator, so the sun's shining on it and it's heading north. And because the sun's shining on it, it gets hot and the water evaporates and it gradually becomes more salty, but it's also carrying heat. So it keeps on heading north and it delivers its heat to Europe and the east coast of the USA. And then it gets close to the pole, the North Pole, and it gets cold and the denser water falls down to the bottom. So it's the overturning. So it overturns and then it heads back down and the current goes on and on. And what they're worried about is that the two things can influence it: the overall change in currents due to global warming, but more importantly, the huge influx of fresh water coming from Greenland and melting ice in the Arctic, which can push it further south and, in fact, switch it off. If it switches off, the east coast of the USA and the west coast of Europe will become a lot colder. What can we do to stop it? Six words, just six words: keep fossil fuel in the ground.
Great. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
All right. Sam from Hay, New South Wales, what's your question about sunsets?
Yes, hello, everyone. How do the deep, vibrant colours form for sunrises and sunsets, and why in May are they seemingly more vibrant than other times of the year?
Sam, they have been beautiful.
That is such a great question. Sunsets are more red and orange and all those deep, vibrant hues compared to, you know, during the day. It's because the sunlight has to travel through more atmosphere, so that light gets scattered more. And the blue light is higher frequency. The purple and the blues, they get scattered away first. So all that remains is the orange and the red. And it's one of those funny things where, like, the more kind of dust is in the air, the more air pollution there is, the more gorgeous the sunsets. I am not a big fan of Los Angeles, but the sunsets there are amazing because the air quality is not.
So. Oh, yeah. Okay. Interesting.
And May? Why May? That's, we're out of pollen season, are we? Or are we?
Carl, this is on you. I don't know.
I'm not sure, but Sam, I do agree with you.
It's been gorgeous.
Yeah.
That's interesting because in Hay Plains out here, there's not that much pollution unless there's fires around, things like that. So thank you.
Would there be winds that are carrying the dust?
Yeah, maybe dust.
Definitely wind.
Interesting. Sarah, in your Sydney, you've got a question about AI. What do you want to know?
Well, thanks so much, Dr. Carl and Dr. Peter, for exploring AI with us. My question's really about prepping the future generation of humans. So maybe just some suggestions for you for young people and for educators on adapting and thriving as AI infiltrates and disrupts traditional career paths.
Wow, great question.
Yeah, this is a really, really good, really, really important question that I don't fully know how to answer, apart from there are things that are really important and really human, and we need to make sure that we continue protecting that. I think one of the things, there's a thing known as cognitive offloading, where instead of doing the homework yourself, you just, you know, a lot of young people just paste it into ChatGPT and it just spits out the answers at them. And that's really bad, obviously, and there's scientific data that supports that. So I would strongly encourage, when you feel that, you know, the want to lean on a crutch that is AI, just to put in the effort yourself. If it looks like pulling an all-nighter to get the assignment done, it'll be worth it because you will actually learn. Yeah.
Peter, yeah, we've talked...
Remember.
Yeah, exactly, Sarah, and lock it in the brain. We've talked a lot about some of the more sinister aspects of AI. There's fear around it. Is there anything you can give us in the way of hope or you know, something to look to, Dr. Carl?
Yeah, so there was a woman who had breast cancer, which happens to one in every 8 women, 1 in 40 die, and she had a rocky course but came out okay, and then went to the radiologist and said, can you show me the breast cancer on our most previous, latest mammogram? And he said, yeah, there it is. And he said, now look at the one a year before that and before that. And they found hints of it in the years before. Summarise, they worked out an AI that can pick up breast cancer up to 5 years early.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good.
If we get this technology right, it could be the best thing that has ever happened, right? There's so much knowledge that is required to make, you know, the future go really well, and AI can really, really help us there. Mm-hmm. I really do think that we can make tool-specific AIs that can do things like solve cancer.
But we're in a kind of situation of having knowledge but not wisdom. We have the knowledge to give every Australian from a baby to an adult a fully loaded AK-47 as well as some explosive and some polonium poison, but we have the wisdom not to do it. Mm-hmm. With AI, we're just rolling it out. Everybody who wants an automatic rifle, here, take one. That's what we're doing.
Okay. Dr. Peter, you speak on this pretty regularly, but also in the world of physics. Where can we check out more of your work?
Yeah, I do a lot of stuff on YouTube and Instagram and all the usual places. I am Science Peter, spelt the, you know, Slavic way because my parents were in a hurry. So Science P-E-T-R. Yeah, I'd love to connect.
Hell yeah. Science Peter, thank you so much for joining us this week on Science with Dr. Carl.
This was so much fun. Thank you so much for
Yay!
Having me.
Oh, we love it. We love having you on. Dr. Carl, I'll catch you next week.
Peachy keen.
And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. We will chuck Dr. Peter Lebedev's details for you in the show notes. And that is the same place you can also submit your science questions. Yes, you can submit them live on a Thursday via the Triple J text line, but if you want to get ahead of the curve a little bit, you can submit them via a Google form. Just tell us who you are, where you're from, what your question is, and if we can get you on the phone. That is important. Can't wait to see what you come up with. The link is for you there. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan. I'm Lucy Smith, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.